There she is. All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Skype a Scientist Live. Today, we are going to be talking with Abby Lewis all about lakes and their mysterious natures and how we can learn more about them. So it is the week of Halloween. It is also, for the adults in the room who can vote, the week before the election. If you're in the U.S., I'm sure we're all pretty stressed. But let's just take 45 minutes and just immerse ourselves in some lake science, because it's better than everything else going on, probably. So, Abby, thank you so much for joining us today. Would you like to introduce yourself, say who you are, what you do, and why you like it?
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much for having me. I am so excited to be here. So my name is Abby Lewis. I am a PhD student in the Biological Sciences program at Virginia Tech. And in my research, I'm really interested in understanding how humans impact lakes around the world. And I've done a bunch of different projects kind of all over the place, but a unifying factor is that I've always been really interested in how aspects of a lake that you might not see when you just walk up and look at the lake affect all of the different animals that live in the lake, and whether you can drink that water, so it affects the quality of the water, all of these things. And why do I love it? There are so many reasons. I remember the first research internship I did. We would go out and we would bike through the mountains to these remote lakes, and then we would hike around the lake and go out in a canoe, spend most of the day in a canoe, like collecting samples. And it just blew my mind that this was an actual job that people could do. Like, you could be in these absolutely gorgeous places and get paid to do it. So beautiful lakes are definitely a huge factor. I think before I started doing science, I never realized how collaborative science could be. And that's been a huge factor for me, getting to work with awesome teams of people from around the world. Every time we go out to do our research, there's at least one other person who's there with you. So you form these friendships, and I've learned so much from working with other people. And then the last thing is that I wouldn't be doing this research if I didn't think it was meaningful and if it could, you know, help people down the road. So we know that freshwater resources are both vital, they're essential. You can't live without water, and they're scarce, and the demand for water is increasing, while the quality of the water in lakes and reservoirs around the world is generally decreasing over time. So it's really important to me that we find ways to protect that water and make sure that we all have tasty, healthy water into the future. So I put together a couple of slides just to show what it looks like to do lake ecology, because I think before I started doing this, I really had no idea what that really meant. So this first slide is really just to show you what I mean when I say that lakes are beautiful. These are some of the amazing places that I've gotten to work over the past few years. In the top left corner, this is me in a lake at the field station at Pomona College, which is where I went to college. And you can see the beautiful mountains in the distance. And then I was studying the effect that light has on lakes. So these are little solar panel lights that I stuck in the lake to see how they would affect the way that the lake functions. In the middle here, I'm at Lake Mývatn in Iceland, which was another internship that I did in college, and that was a super amazing experience and just such a cool lake to study. And also really, really beautiful, as you can see here. And that's the same lake that's shown in the top right over here. And then this is me actually sometime this week out at Falling Creek Reservoir, which is where I do my research now. And Falling Creek is a drinking water reservoir, which means that this water can be treated and sent to people's homes where it would come out of the tap when they pour a glass of water. So it's been really amazing to work with the water managers there and figure out ways to make sure that we ensure that everyone has access to really safe drinking water. The picture in the bottom left here is one of those lakes that I was talking about from my very first research internship. This is in New York, and it's a bummer that the picture is so small, because it really is a truly beautiful place. And then I also stuck this picture at the top here, which is just a photo of algae in the reservoir. So the scum that you'll sometimes see. But I thought it was just incredible to see the turquoise color of that algae. So thinking about how even aspects of lakes that you might not immediately think of as beautiful or important really can be. Another thing I was blown away about when I first started doing lake ecology is this microscopic world of things that live in the water. So if you just look at water, you can't see that these things are there, but there are microscopic plants floating in the water and microscopic animals. And the first time that I looked under a microscope, I gasped to see how geometric these shapes are and how many things are in that water. And the last slide I put together here is a picture of the mud or the sediment at the bottom of the lake, which I've started studying recently because I think this is one of those factors that you may not see initially, but ends up being really important to the quality of your water. So the picture on the left is me just kind of feeling the sediment to get a sense of what it looks like, what's in there. And the picture on the right is where that sediment came from. So you drop this kind of contraption all the way down to the bottom of the reservoir or the lake, and you can pull up the sediment and take a look at it on shore. And that's what that looks like. The picture in the middle is the same thing, except it's sediment from Lake Mývatn in Iceland, which is the lake that I mentioned earlier. And Lake Mývatn is really interesting. So the word Mývatn means midge lake. And each of these little tubes that you can see here was built by an insect, a midge, which are like really tiny flies. And there are tons and tons of them. The reason this lake has been named after midges is because the population of midges can get so large that it really impacts the functioning of the lake and even the surrounding land. So every summer you get, I think it's an equivalent weight as 4 whales of midges coming out of the lake, and they'll come out and a lot of them fall on the surrounding land where they'll die, and then the nutrients from the midge end up feeding the next generation of plants growing there. So if you look at a satellite image, there's this like lava volcanic landscape with almost no plants growing until you get to the area immediately surrounding the lake where it's bright green from all of the plants that are able to grow because of these midges in the lake. So I've always been really interested in those connections, and it would be cool to talk more about that today.
All right, that was super cool. I cannot believe, I'm just so glad that I don't live near Lake Midge, because do they bite?
They don't bite. Okay, okay. They're pretty amazing because they'll get in your face a little bit, but They actually don't hurt you at all.
Okay. Whew. Okay, good. That's a relief. So here's a question. And also for our audience, if you have questions, please submit them. Don't be shy. Into the Q&A function at the bottom, just type them in there. And we'll get to them in the order that they come in. So my question is, is the entire bottom of that lake just covered in those tubes? And does that prevent other animals from getting use out of the bottom of the lake?
Interesting question. So it's not uniform across the whole bottom of the lake. There are areas where there are more midges and areas where there aren't, and that changes between years. And no one really knows exactly why that is. That's an area of research that we're still working on. And how it affects other organisms. So I'm not sure exactly how it would affect other animals living on the bottom, but I know that there are some really interesting relationships between the midges. So it's midge larvae. It's like baby midges growing up in the sediment. Mm-hmm. And they'll work with algae. So they'll like build these tubes, and part of the reason they have the tubes is to live in, but part of the reason is that it's like a little mini algae farm, because the algae can grow on the outside there and then they come out and they eat it. And I thought that was so interesting how they're able to engineer their environment to benefit themselves.
Love a good symbiosis. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. All right. So we've got a question from Brielle. What do you think lakes will look like in the future?
Great question. So it's really hard to say, right? There are a bunch of different trends happening at the same time. One trend that is probably worth talking about is that in general, as the climate is getting warmer, that's affecting lake temperatures. So if you look at temperatures in lakes kind of around the world, a lot of lakes, the surface water is increasing pretty substantially over time. And that affects a lot of different things, right? So when the temperature is warmer, algae can grow faster, and so you get more algal blooms than you might otherwise. It also can affect fish. If fish require cold water to live in, having warm temperatures is really hard for them. The other thing that's really interesting about lakes, and something that I didn't know before I started doing lake ecology, is that lakes stratify. And what that means is that there's warm water at the top and cold water at the bottom, and they really don't mix. So if you think about this, like if you've ever been swimming in a lake, and then you like go down a little bit, or maybe your feet feel really cold and the rest of your body is a normal temperature, that's because you're seeing that temperature change between the warm layer and the cold layer. And this matters a lot for a bunch of different processes. It's an important aspect of how lakes function. But because the warm water is getting warmer, that stratification becomes stronger and it becomes harder for like gases in the bottom water to move up to the top. And because the warm season is starting earlier and ending later, you have a longer duration where they're stratified, which can also affect a lot of aspects of how lakes function. So if we talk about general trends, lakes are getting greener. There's more algae. Lakes are also getting browner. So there's more dirt and leaves, and it's called dissolved organic matter. And I think the best parallel for dissolved organic matter is like if you're having a cup of tea and you put your tea bag in your water, you'll see that the water turns brown as little bits of the leaves dissolve into the water. And that's happening more and more in lakes around the world. And then also warmer.
Awesome. Well, thanks for answering that. The next question is, and you may have to explain what this question means, but how does biomagnification affect lakes differently than it would other bodies of water? And what even does that word mean? If you don't know, we'll...
I don't know. That's a great question. I'm not sure.
Okay, cool. The next question is from Kaylee, who's 4 years old. Ballpark, how many lakes are there in the world?
Also a fantastic question, and I also have no idea. So I grew up in Wisconsin, which has a lot of lakes. I think there are about 15,000 lakes in Wisconsin.
Oh my God.
Yeah, but that's not true everywhere around the world. So not every state is going to have 15,000 lakes. I now moved to Virginia, and Virginia has 2 natural lakes. And all of the rest of the bodies of water in Virginia are reservoirs. So they're built by humans. Right. There are about 500,000 reservoirs worldwide. But in terms of an actual number for the number of lakes in the world, it would be really hard to say.
A lot. Okay, so here's a follow-up question that I had because of that question. What exactly is the difference between a lake, a pond, and a sea?
Awesome question. Yeah, so this actually, it sounds like a simple question, but it's a pretty active area of research that people are working on creating these definitions because it's not clear-cut. So a pond is smaller than a lake. There are some cutoffs in terms of numbers that people throw around, but we're still kind of creating those numbers for how you classify a pond versus a lake. And you would imagine that it's not really a sharp cutoff, right? Like there are some in-between lakes that could kind of go either way, and they might function more as ponds or more as lakes depending on the time of year. Cool. My understanding is that a sea is salt water, but I actually... I'm not 100% confident in that.
I'm also like 80% confident about that. So between the two of us, it's mostly true. Maybe there's like one weird example where it's not true, but I'm pretty sure that's always true.
So it's also interesting because sometimes people will count the Caspian Sea as the largest lake just because it's an inland body of water. Right. So I think a lot of the time you can think of lakes as a general umbrella category, and then under that umbrella you have seas, ponds, reservoirs, all of these different types of lakes.
Cool. All right. Good to know. Brielle would like to know, how does pollution affect lakes?
Yeah, great question. So it does. The short answer is it does. If you have one of the main forms of pollution that you'll see in lakes is nutrient pollution. So these are like pesticides and fertilizers that people will put on their agricultural crops. And when it rains, the rain will wash some of those pesticides and fertilizers right into the water. And just as on land, it would help your plants grow in the water, it also helps plants grow. And so you get algae, so like microscopic plants growing in your water. And that can make your water quality a lot worse in a couple different ways, right? So sometimes when you have plants growing in the water, they can release toxins into your water that makes it so that you can't drink the water. They can also, they have really short lifespans, like algae, so it'll fall to the bottom and it'll decompose. And decomposition uses up oxygen. So you can think of that like how when you breathe in, you're breathing in more oxygen and releasing more carbon dioxide. And so when these plants, they're getting eaten up by microbes, and the microbes are also breathing in oxygen and releasing carbon dioxide. And then that's a big problem if you don't have oxygen, because fish need to breathe in the water. And when you don't have oxygen, you can also get metals released into your water.
Awesome. Thanks for answering that. The next question is from Mrs. Jeffries. I'm here with my sixth grade students. They want to know, what difference have you noticed in the biodiversity between different lakes?
Super interesting. Yeah. What differences have I noticed? So I think one of the most obvious differences is between Lake Nývatn in Iceland, where I was working, and some of the other lakes in the US where I'm working. And Lake Nývatn has obviously like these huge midge populations, but they also have, I think like 15 different types of ducks come to this lake. So a huge diversity of ducks. And that's partially because of the midges, and because there's a lot of food for those ducks to eat in this lake in the middle of Iceland. Some issues that can cause biodiversity to decrease are when you get those same algal blooms or negative water quality problems going on.
Sounds good. Another animal related question. This is a fun one. Does depth affect the diversity of life in lakes? For example, so I'm a marine biologist, and I know the person asking this question is also super interested in marine life. And we see like super weird animals deep in the ocean. Like, do we get weirdo animals living deep in lakes too?
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. And I would want to look into this more because I often don't study animals. So I am maybe not the best position to answer this, but I will say that, it's really hard for animals to live without oxygen in general. So if the bottom of your lake doesn't have very much oxygen, you're going to have very few things living down there. But you do have some weirdos, right? Like, so you have some microbes that are able to live without oxygen, and that's pretty crazy. That's pretty awesome. But you're probably going to have a lot more things living in the surface waters than you do in the bottom waters.
So then is like the mixing of ocean water, just like, does ocean water just mix more than lake water does?
Good question. It seems possible. Yeah, it seems, I would imagine that there's quite a bit of mixing driven by air circulation patterns and that sort of thing, winds over the ocean. Whereas lakes might be smaller and not mix as often. Another thing that can sometimes make it hard to live, or I imagine it might make it hard to live in the bottom of a lake, is that the environment can change pretty dramatically. So in the summer, so in these lakes that stratify into a warm zone and a cold zone, you might not have very much oxygen in the summer, but you might have a lot of oxygen in the winter, and it can, that change might be difficult. I'm really not sure. Yeah, I'm really not sure why there would be differences between the ocean and lakes.
Sounds good. Sometimes that's just more space for research, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome.
Also, I think because lakes are a smaller environment, there just aren't as many things that can live in a lake as can live in the ocean.
Right. Yeah.
And so it might be harder to, you know, to find those sorts of animals.
Exactly. Cool. The next question is from Jen. Our neighborhood pond has a lot of pond weeds. The board puts chemicals in the water to kill the weeds just in the swimming area and by the fishing docks. But how does that affect the whole lake?
Yeah. So that's also a really good question. I imagine that it's pretty hard to isolate chemicals to a certain part of the lake. So if you put chemicals just in the area near the swimming dock, it's probably going to spread towards the rest of the lake also. And so I imagine you would get some of those same weeds in other parts of the lake might be impacted by that. And that affects other aspects of the ecosystem. So if there are animals that depend on those weeds as like a habitat, they could also be impacted by the chemicals that are added. Oh, I can't hear you.
Sorry, I have a fish tank going in the background that's very noisy, at least to me, so I always worry that you all hear that bubbling too. Anyway, Brielle, age 8, would like to know, what's your favorite lake?
Oh, wow, it's so hard to pick. So hard to pick. Growing up in Wisconsin, I have an affinity for the Great Lakes. I grew up about half an hour from Lake Michigan and spent some time on Lake Superior also. So I think either Lake Michigan or Lake Superior is a really good bet. Lake Superior also happens to be the biggest freshwater lake in the world in terms of surface area. So that's pretty awesome.
That is awesome.
And it's just, both of them are really, really beautiful in a lot of places.
Awesome. All right, the next question is from Diana. Is there any way to test for bacteria in a lake quickly before you go in, so you like figure out whether or not you're about to be the meal of flesh-eating bacteria?
not that I know of. People are working on developing some really cool technologies that can basically do that. So you can take like a tiny sample of water. It can tell you basically all of the different types of bacteria that live in that water. And so I don't think it fully exists yet. And I think once it does, it'll be a mere, you know, couple tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars to be able to do that. Unfortunately, I don't think there's an easy answer here.
Yeah, I don't know either. I've never worried about that before jumping in a lake, but maybe I should start worrying. I'm not really sure.
I think the thing is, if it's a public beach, they're going to be testing that water and they'll be aware if there are any major problems. And if it's not, you can kind of get a sense based on the color of the water whether you think it's going to be safe and healthy to swim in.
Sounds good. The next question is also from Mrs. Jeffries. Do volcanoes form under lakes?
Interesting. So lakes form in volcanoes, sometimes. So some of you may have heard of Crater Lake in Oregon, which is formed. It's in a volcano that has erupted, and then there's just this like crater left behind, and rainwater can fall in and it eventually forms a crater lake. And that can happen. And it's not just Crater Lake. There are a bunch of other lakes that are formed in volcanic craters around the world. The lake in Iceland is not in a crater of a volcano, but it's also in an area of volcanic activity, and because of that there's this like divot that has been filled in with water. Do lakes form under volcanoes? I imagine that volcanoes can happen anywhere, and lakes can happen anywhere, so I imagine it's possible for a volcano to form under a lake, but usually it's going to be the opposite.
Sounds good. So typically the volcano comes first. That's good to know. All right, so the next question is, does pollution and fertilizer runoff increase the lake water temperature?
Not directly, but indirectly there are definitely ties there. So if water runs along a surface, it can heat up. So like in cities, when rain falls and it runs along the pavement for a long time, that pavement's going to warm up your water, and then eventually it gets into your lake and it is going to increase the temperature of the lake. And the reason that's tied to pollution is that at the same time that it's heating up along the pavement, it's also gathering some pollution that can be put into the lake. You also, so when your water is a darker color, so if it's brown or green, the sun heats that up more than it would if it was just clear. So you can think of that like if you were wearing a black shirt outside, you're gonna get warmer than if you were wearing a clear a white shirt, you know. And so because of the pollution that's like causing algal blooms or bringing in a lot of dirt and stuff into the water, that water might warm up more than it would without pollution.
Sounds good. Madeline Jenkins would like to know, do some animals live only in the warm part of the lake and others live only in the cold part of the lake?
Yeah. So my understanding, again, don't do too much animal research, but my understanding is that there are fish that prefer warm temperatures versus cold temperatures. So there are cold water fish that are going to want to always be in the colder water. Another animal in lakes, so we've talked a lot about fish, but there are also microscopic animals called zooplankton. So plankton just means floating. Zoo is like if you go to the zoo. So animal, floating animals in the lake. And they'll have parts of the lake that they prefer, but we're also, in my research group, we're studying their migration. So in the nighttime, they want to hide in the dark, cold waters so that they don't get eaten by the fish. In the daytime, they want to hide in the dark, cold waters so they don't get eaten by the fish. But then at nighttime, when the fish can't see them, they'll come up to the top where all the food is, and they'll make that migration all the way up to the top so that they can eat the tasty algae and then go back down to the bottom. And there are different types of zooplankton that have different places where they prefer to be. Some of them do this vertical migration, and then some of them also, they'll like go straight to the side and hide in the plants as their like dark place to avoid the fish.
Cool. Thanks. The next question is, how do fish and other animals that are in lakes get introduced to the lakes? Like I know in a previous session, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, we talked a lot about invasive species and how zebra mussels are a big problem. Like how do they get there in the first place?
Yeah, awesome question. So I know the big issue with zebra mussels tends to be boats. That boats will come, and if you take a boat from one lake that has zebra mussels, then you can get zebra mussels on the boat, and then when you bring it to the next one, they come off and they're like, oh, here's a wonderful new place where there's all sorts of space for me to live, and they can start living there. The other, if you're thinking other than zebra mussels, there are all sorts of other animals that also need to move between lakes, right, if your lake is ever going to have fish in it. So that can happen because of people. When I was doing research in this little lake in California, we would sometimes find turtles, just like turtles that people had as pets, and then they'll release them and you get these like invasive turtles in your pond. For zooplankton that we were just talking about, they'll sometimes travel on birds, which I've always thought is really interesting. So if the bird like swoops in and eats a fish or something, it could get one of these microscopic animals just like tagging along on its leg. And then when it goes to the next lake, the little zooplankton friends can start living in this new lake also. So there's natural transmission of animals between lakes, and there's also human-driven transmission.
Cool, thanks. The next question, what made you want to learn about lakes in the first place?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So my first research, I think this is kind of a story about perseverance. The first time I applied for research internships, I applied to 6 different positions and I was rejected from 6 different positions. I didn't get anything. The next year I applied for research internships and I applied for 13 positions and I got rejected from 12 positions. So that last one that I went to happened to be a lake ecology position. And I remember in my interview for that position, the advisor asked me like, so what made you decide that you want to spend your career researching freshwater ecosystems? And I'm sitting there like, did I make that decision? I don't remember making that decision.
Right.
But I really didn't. I, you know, at that point, I'd certainly had not decided that that's what I wanted to do, and I told her that. But through the course of that summer, spending a lot of time on these New York lakes, and I just slowly fell in love with the concept of studying lakes. And I've always felt like subjects are more interesting once you already know something about them. So the more I learned about lakes, the more questions I had, and the more I wanted to learn more. And I guess, yeah, the rest is history. I've kept asking more questions and learning more and learning more, and gotten to the point where I am today.
Awesome. That's a great story. Thank you. The next question is from Kaylee, age 4. What is the most dangerous thing in a lake?
I think the answer to this question most of the time when you ask about any ecosystem is humans. That when I was doing my research, I would be in California. I would be alone at the field station, and I was never really worried about anything from the lake hurting me. I was worried about people randomly showing up and surprising me there. And humans, you know, have had really devastating impacts on a lot of different ecosystems around the world. But if we're talking about an animal, it's gonna depend a lot on the lake. I know in some of the Great Lakes, there are lake sturgeon, which are pretty gigantic. A lot of the times what has the potential to be dangerous are microbes, so bacteria in the lake that could make you sick if you're like drinking that water.
Right. Sounds good. The next question is from Rory, age 8. How can you get rid of pollution in lake water?
$1 million question. Yeah. So I was listening to a podcast that related to this the other day, talking about New York City's water supply and how absolutely astounding it is that we're able to get enough water for all of the people in New York City to drink and take showers and all of that every single day. It's like, I think 1 billion gallons of water passes through New York City every single day. So to be able to do that, we are going to connect back to the question, I promise. To be able to do that, they had to make sure that they had a supply of water that's safe enough for everyone in New York City. And it would be really expensive to have to filter that water. So instead of investing money in better water treatment plants, they invested water in protecting the watershed. So the city of New York bought up 40% of the land surrounding two major rivers, and they just protected it. So it's like a natural forest ecosystem. And in that ecosystem, water will come in and it gets filtered through the soil, which removes any contaminants that would be in that water. And so by the time the water is in the river, it's really good quality water. And because of that, the city of New York only filters 10% of the water. 90% of the water is unfiltered because they have such good water coming in. And so they still treat it, right? It's not like raw river water. They blast it with UV and add chlorine, I think. But because the best way to remove pollution is to have natural ecosystems that can use up all of those nutrients. And so the other place where you'll see that is in like agricultural systems. If you have a farm that's right next to a river, you can put in a bunch of like trees and plants between your farm and the river, and those trees and plants love the nutrients. So they'll use up all of your nutrients before it gets into the river, and that can do a lot to protect the quality of your water.
That's super cool. I had no idea that that's how New York approached its water problem. That's so, so interesting.
It is, and New York is known for having good water now. You know, if you think about like New York bagels or New York pizza, the story is that the reason they're able to make such good bagels and pizza is because they have good water, and right. New Yorkers are really proud of their water, but it's because of this like natural approach to managing water. The awesome. Stuff You Should Know podcast is where I heard that.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Good plug. All right. The next question is, does algae in the lake affect animals on the land?
Does algae in the lake affect animals on the land? Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So even if an animal lives on land, just like humans, everyone needs to drink, right? So if animals go up to that water and they start drinking it and it's really bad quality, that can also make animals sick. So you'll hear stories of like ponds that get really polluted and somebody's dog will go up and drink from it, and it has actually killed dogs to be drinking really polluted water.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awful.
Yeah.
Really sad. A related question is from a second grade student in Wyoming. Where is the most polluted water stream, lake, or river?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think usually the places that end up being most polluted are agricultural ponds. So if you have a little pond on your farm and there's a lot of like cow poop and chicken poop that's getting washed into that water, that poop has a lot of nutrients, and so that can cause really bad quality water. And it's not just the nutrients, right? So there are also like, if you give your cows medicine, antibiotics, that can get into the water also. So it'd be hard to say a specific system, but it's probably one of these small ponds.
Yeah. Sounds good. So never drink the water. Well, in general, should we never be drinking lake water? Is that like a thing? Is that like a rule we should be implementing in our lives?
You should definitely be treating the water before you drink it. Yeah. So if you're swimming, probably don't drink it. If you're like backpacking and you need a source of water, you can bring a little filter that'll help you be able to drink that water.
Sounds good. All right. How common, this is a question that I actually was curious about and someone else asked it too, so I'm grateful that they did. How common are brain-eating amoebae in lakes? This is the thing that freaks me out. I'm a swimmer, I'm a water polo player, and I like hear about these open water swims, be it in like the Boston Harbor or out in a lake, and that's the one thing. I'm like, at least I know in pools, a brain-eating amoeba isn't going to get me. Like, is that a problem?
Yeah, I think it's probably not so much of a problem as people make it out to be. It's one of those things where it's so scary.
You know, like it's like one brain-eating amoeba and is too many for me.
I don't think that's something you need to be worried about on a daily basis. I think it's one of these things like quicksand or something that we we hear a lot of stories about, but you're probably not actually going to run into it in real life.
Right. Okay. Sounds good. Let's see. What is your favorite living thing that lives in lakes?
Interesting. So yeah, one of the types of algae that I showed you on one of my slides is, I'm just going to pull it up again because it's so wonderful. It's this, can I go back? Here we go. This type of algae here, it's called a pediastrum. And I have strong emotional attachment to this because this is one of the first types of algae that I learned to identify. And I think they're so beautiful how they form these whole like communities. So each individual kind of shape here is a cell. And then there are a bunch of them that all live together. And
so is that like a flat pancake that we're looking at, or is it like a beach ball?
Yeah, no, it's like a flat pancake. Yep.
That's cool.
And they're amazing. And I love how they all live together and keep each other safe. And I love how beautiful they are. I love the fact that this is not something many people know about. So now all of you are part of the select few that have heard of the pediastrum.
They're really beautiful. Thanks for sharing that. It's so cool. Here's a question from Gavin. Are there any freshwater sharks that live in lakes?
No. Do you know the answer to this question?
I think the answer is no. Like, there are sharks that can go between saltwater and freshwater, including the bull shark, and there are a couple others, but I don't think there are any that just live in lakes all the time. There are some that live in like the Mediterranean, but that's salt water as well.
Yeah.
I don't know about the Caspian Sea. They may have gotten in there, and then was the Caspian Sea originally connected to an ocean and then got cut off?
Like a very, very long time ago. Yeah.
But sharks have been around for something like 375, 400 million years. like a really, 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 really long time. So, but anyway, in lakes, I don't think so, but I wouldn't like bet my life on that answer.
I have a vague recollection of there being freshwater sharks in Lake Nicaragua.
Oh.
But I'm, again, don't quote me on this.
Okay, I'll look into that. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So we're going to do a rapid fire here because we still have questions left, but we're at the end of our like natural time. So let's see if we can rip through some of these. Some of them, thankfully, we've already done. What's your favorite lake plant?
Well, so Pediastrum, which I just showed you.
Pediastrum, great. Next, what is the deepest lake?
The deepest lake is Lake Baikal, which is in Russia. Russia. And it's great. Over a mile deep.
Whoa, that is deep. That is super cool. Next question, what is the main way that pollution gets into lakes?
So I would say the main way is from running, so it's from water that's running off the land and into the lake, and it carries with it a bunch of pollution.
Cool. From Angela, how can you deduce the health of the lake by test, or can you deduce the health of the lake by testing the mud at the bottom by the look and the feel? And are there any other predictors of lake health?
So actually, rather than the look and the feel, there are chemical tests that you can do with the water. And then one of the things that I think is really cool is that you can look at the different insects that are living at the bottom of the lake or a river or something like that. And based on what's able to live in that water, you can get a sense of how healthy it is.
Awesome. Looking at the insects. Super cool. Did any dinosaurs live in lakes?
They've got to, probably.
Sure. I think almost definitely.
Yeah.
There were some
they definitely drank water from lakes.
Somebody lived in a lake. There were dinosaurs loved water. So I always, in all the drawings of them, they're always hanging out by water. So at least next to a lake.
Sounds good.
For your work, do you go on boats?
Yes, every day.
Every day. Awesome. And our final question, even though we have a lot more, but we got to wrap it up, is can jellyfish live in freshwater?
Oh, this is another.
Yes. Yes, jellyfish live in freshwater.
Great.
They're super cool.
Thank you all for so many questions. This was really awesome.
This was really great. We got more questions in this session than we've had in a while. So I'm so glad that you all came and you all brought your curiosity with you. Abby, thanks for sharing all your knowledge about lakes. This was a super cool half hour. Erin, thank you for signing for us. So we always have two questions that we ask everybody at the end of each session. The first is, you have everyone's attention in the entire world. And you can tell them one thing about lakes. What is it?
Wow, there's a lot of pressure. I think it's just that lakes are awesome. Like, lakes are amazing. And it's so important that you protect the water that you live near and that you appreciate what an amazing resource it is to have fresh water and all of the wonderful things that live in lakes and how absolutely beautiful they are.
Awesome. All right, follow-up question. You still have everyone's attention in the entire world, and you can tell them one more thing, but it can't be about lakes. It has to be about something else. It can be as serious and big picture or silly and insignificant as you'd like.
Look up pictures of smooth lump suckers because they're incredible.
That's a really good thing to say. I'm so glad you said that. I can't believe no one said that before on these sessions. No one's told us to look at smooth lump suckers, but they are so cute. That's wonderful. Thank you for saying that. That's great. Is there anywhere that we can find you on social media? Anything you'd like to plug?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter @Lewis_lakes. And I'd love to, if there are more questions, that's a great place that you can ask them. And I can give you more thoughtful answers over Twitter also.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for taking the time to be with us. Audience, thank you for coming today. We hope to see you at our next session. You can always find out what we have going on at skypeascientist.com and click the events tab. And you can see we have things scheduled all the way out till January. And we'll be updating that with more sessions in November and January and also December as we go. Erin, thank you for taking the time to sign with us. Also, I really like your big cat shirt today. It is very cute. Very cute. Okay, everybody, we will see you next time. Thank you so much for joining us. Bye.